Hello, this is Serena, and what follows is my commentary on the passages I read from Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections, pages 521 through 526 in the paperback. The passage excerpts that I read are most immediately relevant for their unveiling of the novel's best-kept secret. Why does a stable, driven man with good job security and a potential to double his pension in 2 years' time decide suddenly to quit and relegate his family to a lower standard of living than the one he had been working to ensure? Even though nothing is ever confirmed out loud, Denise's discovery of the penciled heart and her subsequent speculation about the circumstances leading up to her father's retirement provide us with solid, if tragic, answers to questions raised throughout the novel. Finally, we understand why the blue-cheeked, pedenda-pink-lipped Don Armore appeared in Alfred's bathroom hallucination, and why Alfred muses, somewhat cryptically on page 68, that the betrayal had begun in Signals. However, what makes this passage so key to the novel is not simply that it answers a long-held question, but that it illuminates each character in turn and affects a change in both the novel's direction and in our perception of what has gone before. From the single revelation of Don Armore stem countless other, smaller revelations that overturn the characters' notions of each other and have significant long-term relevance. Crouching to examine the underbelly of the bench, Denise discovers the contents of the U-Ban cans. Watching her daughter break down with remorse, Enid sees in Denise a sympathetic expression of the helplessness she feels. Although Denise has spent much of her life deploring the deplorable in her mother, she is finally forced to recognize the grim reality of Enid's life with Alfred. Similarly, Enid, whose stubborn refusal to acknowledge the seriousness of Alfred's condition has kept her afloat until this point, is finally forced to admit to herself and to her daughter that Alfred will not recover. Perhaps the most striking insights are the ones we gain with regard to Alfred's character and the nature of his relationship with his children. 30 pages from the novel's end, just when things appear to be headed for utter ruin, we are asked to re-examine everything we have come to know about this man in light of his notions about love. Franzen establishes Alfred's need for privacy early in the novel and reinforces at every opportunity our reading of Alfred as an intensely private, disciplined man. Alfred resents his loudly amorous hotel neighbors and retreats to the closed space of his metallurgy lab whenever possible. He is particularly resentful of his body, which he feels is capable of betraying his privacy at any moment and shaming him either with unwanted sexual urges or the myriad embarrassments of his disease. This is taken one step further when, on page 464, he cuts short a contemplation of suicide with the assertion that being seen as a finite carcass in a sea of blood and bone chips and gray matter would be a violation of privacy so profound it seemed it would outlive him. Since the very nature of privacy is that of selfishness, of wanting space, time, and knowledge entirely to oneself, Alfred's remove from the people around him appears coolly self-indulgent and, in the context of his family, sadly despicable. His apparent lack of interest in his children's lives, particularly when contrasted with Enid's prying curiosity, discourages communication, and his tendency to withhold important information about his own life makes it difficult to reconcile his preferred roles as engineer and amateur scientist with his more permanent role as father. The selfishness of privacy seems to be in direct opposition to the selflessness so often attributed to parenthood, and, until the revelation about Don Armore, we are left without a readily discernible link between the two. What the presence of the penciled heart allows us to do is to redefine privacy, not as a matter of personal interest, but as a gift to be bestowed on others, an indirect expression of love. By hiding his knowledge of Denise's tryst and internalizing his feelings of betrayal for 15 years, Alfred saved his daughter's privacy and allowed her to live free of guilt, despite the far-reaching consequences of her actions. His relationship with Denise, founded in part on his need to redeem himself for shaming her in the womb, page 278, can be reinterpreted as a mutual assurance of privacy toward the prevention of shame, with both parties sacrificing a close personal relationship in favor of keeping each other free from burden. Furthermore, if we consider how Alfred equates privacy with individuality and independence, noting on page 463 that without privacy there was no point in being an individual, his insistence on privacy in a familial setting may be read as an attempt on his part to allow his children some freedom of identity. Not surprisingly, the seeds for this reinterpretation of Alfred's character may be found at several key points in previous chapters. At the end of the third chapter, Alfred's half-drowned musings reveal an incredible warmth of feeling for his children and the ultimate solidity of their existence in his life. Also of considerable interest is Alfred's desire, on page 264, for his wife to abandon her ping-pong game and come disturb him. The fact that he braces himself to accept her comforts every time she approaches his lab door reveals an underlying expectation, a pressing need for privacy to be broken where family is concerned. Almost incongruous at the time of their initial reading, these moments of insight lend credence, in retrospect, to Denise's explication of her father. Of course, part of what makes these observations so fascinating is the fact that our understanding of Alfred's love comes about only through the realization of its failure. Ultimately, he does not succeed in protecting Denise from his knowledge of her betrayal, nor does he succeed in maintaining the boundaries of his privacy. He urinates on the bed, he exposes the penciled heart, he futilely repeats his mantra, "It was never my intention to involve you in this." In class, we talked about how a family differs from Denise's kitchen ideal of privacy and autonomy enjoyed even in the midst of the most sweaty togetherness, page 376. We decided that there is no such thing as an elective family because, after all, we cannot choose what families we are born into. We also noted that Denise's kitchen family operates under certain hierarchical and economic structures, allowing for the easy dismissal of family members in the interest of a more important common goal. Although I'm not refuting either one of these points, I do think that the comparison between kitchen family and blood relations could bear a little more examination. Isn't it the goal of every family to function according to a set of notions about how families ought to function? And isn't it possible for family members to decide whether or not they would like to work toward that goal? Although physical family units are not typically elective, the concept of family is something that must be consciously embraced by the individuals it pertains to. What I would like to suggest is that this conscious embracing of concept is evidenced less through tangible outcomes and events than through the decidedly intangible force of intention. It is a peculiar paradox of intention that allows us to understand the magnitude of Alfred's sacrifices only through the lens of their complete and utter failure. If he had succeeded in keeping Don Armore a secret, we might never have realized, with the aid of Denise's intuition, the absolute strength of his love for her, or the true nature of his dedication to their family. Denise herself might not have realized it. Nearly every non-economic failure can be reduced to a failure of intention, but reduction takes time, and it is so much easier to perceive failure in the red and black world of economic correction. Life, in this vein, is a constant seeking out of mistakes and the corrections they appear to demand. It is an exhausting and bitter cycle that ignores intention completely and focuses solely on a treatment of results. For its first 520 pages, Franz's novel appears to operate according to this model. On page 521, things begin to change. Whether or not I am convinced by the burgeoning possibility of Enid's post-Alfred life, I do believe that the passages I read mark a shift in the character's understanding of failure as corrigible mistake to failure as unfulfilled intention. Recognizing intention, like a ping-pong table whose function has been obscured by years of debris, does nothing to ensure its success or reverse the consequences of its failure. It is merely a statement of fact. My father loved me. That is a ping-pong table. Reassuring for all that it is neither right nor wrong, nor in desperate need of correction.